Thank you, Brother Irwin, and a very pleasant good afternoon, friends. It's the delight of Sister Toni and I to be with you, and we are glad to bring you the love and greetings of your brethren in the Connellsville, Pennsylvania Ecclesia, who are very much with you here in spirit. We begin in today's lesson by considering a text from Exodus chapter 24. Exodus chapter 24, verse 12. And the Lord said unto Moses, Come up to me into the mount, and be there, and I will give thee tables of stone, and a law, and commandments which I have written, that thou mayest teach them. The word law in this text is the Hebrew word Torah. You may also be familiar with the pronunciation Torah, but we understand the more proper pronunciation is Torah. Torah, the word Torah comes from a root word, yara, which means to point out, to give direction. So the Torah is something that gives direction. It gives focus. The Torah is, by definition, a body of divinely given law. And its function has been to direct the people of God in an upward way. Now, we're not necessarily suggesting to heaven, but it gave them an elevating influence. It lifted them up. It made them higher than others around them because of the higher standard that the law set as compared with the standards that were all around them. Now, from our experiences, we've been very blessed to be in Israel several times, and we went over there. One of the things that we've learned is that the Jewish people, when you mention the word Torah to them, most likely they're going to think that you are talking about the first five books of the Bible, the books of Moses, the thing we call the Pentateuch. And so when we use the word Torah in today's lesson, we're going to be using it primarily in this limited sense, in the sense of the five books of Moses. But we'll also be using it occasionally in the broader sense of any divinely given law that we find in the Scriptures. You know, Brother Russell makes a very interesting observation about this 3,500-year-old body of God-given law. And we find this on the page 604, volume 6. And we quote, We are not of those who believe that all the laws and all the regulations of the civilized world are evil. On the contrary, we have frequently been amazed to note how grand are the laws of Christendom, how wise, how just, how noble, many of them evidently enacted with a view to protecting the interests of the weak against the strong and of doing justice to all. Our surprise, on the contrary, may well be that poor, fallen humanity should have ever attained to so grand a system of laws as are to be found on the statute books of Great Britain, the United States, and other countries. We cannot doubt that the law given through Moses and exemplified, multiplied, and made honorable and expounded by our Lord Jesus and his apostles has had much to do with, indeed has been in the basis of, these human laws. Our question for today, is Brother Russell correct in his observation? Has the Torah influenced the system of jurisprudence that you and I live under? That's our focus for today. We'd like to take a look at a number of ways in which we believe that the Torah has influenced the system that you and I operate under and live under today. Let's take a look at the first one. The first area that we consider is one that perhaps sometimes we don't like to talk about, but it's an important one, and it's a very essential one, and that's the area of dispute resolution. You know, imperfect men for many years have devised very different ways in dealing with their differences, in dealing with their disputes. Some of these have been very civilized. And some of these dispute resolution mechanisms that man has created and utilized have been very uncivilized. Now, we don't need to go into detail about either one of those. Now, in our land, and we're talking about the United States, in our land, the sanctioned dispute resolution mechanism is our court system. That's the primary dispute resolution mechanism that we have. That's how we, the world, resolves their disputes. Now, there's many layers of courts in our land. There's the local courts, municipal courts. There's the county courts, state courts. There's also the federal district courts, the circuit courts, and supreme courts. There's also specialty courts like that deal with specialty issues, such as environmental issues, traffic issues. There's many, many layers to our court system, and it goes from coast to coast and from border to border. There's no jurisdiction in this country that doesn't have a court to deal with disputes. Where did this national court system idea come from? We suggest, friends, that it comes from the Torah. It comes from Exodus chapter 18. Exodus chapter 18. Now, Exodus chapter 18, the setting of this chapter, is after the Exodus, after the Israelites came forth from the land of Egypt, from their bondage. After the Exodus, Jethro noticed something that concerned him. He noticed that Moses was going nonstop, day and night, teaching the people and resolving their disputes. Jethro went to his son-in-law, Moses, and he said, in essence, Moses, you can't keep going like this. You can't keep going day and night judging the people. Moses, my son-in-law, my dear son-in-law, I'm going to give you some advice, but this is not advice from me. This is advice coming from God through me to you. Here's the advice, Moses. Set up a court system. Set up a national court system. Moses responds, and he responds by setting up a tiered court system while the Israelites were in the wilderness, and he set this up throughout the nation. Let's look at Exodus chapter 18, picking up with verse 24. So Moses hearkened to the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he said. And Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, rulers over thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. And they judged the people at all seasons. Here, friends, we see the tiered court system. Notice at the top of the tier, there would be certain rulers that would be over thousands. These would be perhaps the courts or the judges that would have multi-tribal jurisdiction, what we call inter-tribal jurisdiction. In other words, they would have jurisdiction over inter-tribal disputes. Some would have jurisdiction over a fewer number, perhaps within the tribe, those who had jurisdiction within the tribe. And within the tribe, perhaps there was a further division of responsibility, a further division of the jurisdiction. Now, this idea of a court system to resolve disputes in the wilderness was not left there, but rather this was made a permanent part of Israel's life when they went into the Promised Land after their wanderings in the wilderness. We find this permanent establishment of the court system in Israel, in Eretz Israel, in Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 18. Judges and officers shalt thou make thee in all thy gates, which the Lord thy God giveth thee throughout thy tribes, and they shall judge the people with just judgment. A corollary text with that we find in Deuteronomy the 25th chapter, verse 1. If there be a controversy between men, and they come into judgment, that the judges may judge them, then they shall justify the righteous and condemn the wicked. Friends, here's our point. In the Torah, the God-given law, the divinely given law to the Israelites, we have the concept of a court system as being the authorized method of dispute resolution. So clearly the Torah embodies this idea that imperfect men need to and should set up a court system to deal with their disputes. Let's look at a second point. Let's look at how the judges in Israel were selected. How did they go about selecting these judges? What was the judge selection methodology? Well, you know, first of all, in our land, in the United States, and we are thinking now and speaking particularly of our state court system, the voters go to the polls and elect their own judges for their own jurisdictions from their own ranks. So the voters select their own judges from within their own ranks to deal with their own disputes. It's very similar to the way that we have elections in our ecclesias, isn't it? The voters are the ecclesia. And where do the servants come from? They come from the very same ecclesia. We don't have one ecclesia selecting the servants for another ecclesia, do we? At least not typically. And neither is that the way that we select our judges. The judges are selected within a jurisdiction from that jurisdiction by the voters of that jurisdiction. Where did this very wise idea come from, of the people selecting their own judges? Let's consider Deuteronomy, the first chapter. Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 8 through 16. Behold, I have set the land before you. Go in and possess the land which the Lord sware unto your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give unto them and to their seed after them. And I spake unto you at that time, saying, I am not able to bear you myself alone. The Lord your God hath multiplied you, and behold, ye are this day as the stars of heaven for multitude. The Lord God of your fathers make you 1,000 times so many more as ye are, and bless you as he hath promised you. How can I myself alone bear your cumbrance and your burden and your strife? Take you wise men and understanding and known among your tribes, and I will make them rulers over you. And ye answered me and said, The thing which thou hast spoken is good for us to do. So I took the chief of your tribes, wise men and known, and made them heads over you, captains over thousands, captains over hundreds, and captains over fifties, and captains over tens, and officers among your tribes. Notice here very carefully how the judges were selected. Moses directed each tribe to select their own judges. These were people that they knew. You know, no one knows you like the person that lives with you. And this was the idea. They were to select their judges, people that they knew, people that they believed within their own ranks were wise. People that they believed that could properly discharge the responsibilities of judgeship. We find this in verse 13 with the one word, you. Take you, wise men, and understanding and known among your tribes. And then notice the last part of that verse. It says, and I will make them rulers over you. So the idea was that each of the tribes was to select their judges. And then Moses was to actually exercise a confirmatory authority upon these judges. We think this was very wise on Moses' part, to let the ranks select their own judges, and then he would confirm them. Essentially, Moses held a veto power, as it were. Just in case, I think just as a safety net, in the event that they would make a bad selection, he would essentially retain a veto power so that a bad judge would not be selected. Or at least it would minimize the possibility of that occurring. So our point, friends, is that the Torah embodies the idea that imperfect men should select their own judges from within their own ranks to deal with their own disputes. Let's consider a third point. The point of evidentiary standards. The point of evidence. Evidence in the courtroom, as it were. Now, if you look at our system today, in our system, findings of liability in civil cases or guilt in criminal cases must be based upon evidence, something that has a probative value, something that a reasonable mind would accept to support a conclusion or a decision. Findings of liability or guilt cannot be based upon hearsay. Cannot be based upon speculation, cannot be based upon allegations, cannot be based upon assumptions, cannot be based upon biases. Again, friends, we're speaking here in theory. We're not suggesting our system is perfect. It doesn't work perfectly. We're looking at concepts as we're going through this. But findings of liability or guilt cannot be based upon anything except evidence. In fact, we have a graduated evidentiary system. the more serious the offense, the higher the evidentiary burden upon the plaintiff in a civil case or on the prosecutor in a criminal case. Where did this concept originate? This idea that liability or guilt must be based upon evidence. Let's consider Deuteronomy, the 19th chapter. Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 15. One witness shall not rise up against a man for any iniquity or for any sin, in any sin that he sinneth. At the mouth of two witnesses, or at the mouth of three witnesses, shall the matter be established. The rule was that it would take at least two witnesses, and preferably three witnesses, to establish either liability, if it was civil liability, or guilt, if it was of a criminal nature of the offense. Now, just as an inquiry at this point, why would our Heavenly Father be interested in setting up this standard? Well, because we think that God was trying to make a point with Israel. He was trying to teach Israel about the sanctity of life. The sanctity of life and the sanctity of liberty. You know, God is saying here, you can't take one's life away from them, or you can't take someone's personal liberty away from them without proof, without positive proof of wrongdoing. Your biases, your inclinations, your gut reactions, they're not good enough. Because I, the Creator, have placed a premium upon life, the sanctity of life. Now, the Heavenly Father seems here as though he is suggesting that if there's going to be an error, he would rather err on the side of preserving life and preserving liberty rather than the opposite. Does it sound familiar in our system today? You're innocent until proven guilty. We think this is a scriptural concept. And you know, it stands in sharp contrast, we understand, to the laws of the heathen nations that were around Israel at this time. You know, God was here teaching the Israelites about the sanctity, the preciousness, the sacredness of life and of liberty. And you know what the heathen nations were emphasizing? They actually elevated materialism. They made property more important than human life. Have we seen any of that recently? Still, the residue of that coming out of some parts of our world? Let's consider a fourth point. This point we call, and you've all heard, no doubt, the concept of due process of law. Now, it's not a scriptural phrase, but in a moment we might see, hopefully we'll see, where it's a scriptural concept. You know, one of the most fundamental tenets of our legal system is due process of law. Now, that's a phrase that not too many people necessarily have ever had occasion to stop and study and to understand. What does it mean? Well, essentially, in its most basic form, due process of law means that one cannot have their property or their life or liberty taken away from them unless they have been treated fairly. So fairness is a fundamental component of this idea of due process of law. Okay, more specifically, what is due process of law? Well, number one, it's the right to be heard. You've heard of having a right to your day in court? Well, that's due process of law, the right to be heard. The right to present evidence. Doesn't do you any good to have a right to be in court if you can't present evidence. The right to have competent legal counsel to assist. The right to have an impartial judge. There's a key component. Let's probe that for just a moment. The right to have an impartial judge is a fundamental part of due process of law. Essentially, what it means to have an impartial judge is somebody who will apply the law even-handedly. A judge that is impartial will not favor a rich man if he is in court with a dispute when a poor man is on the other side. An impartial judge will not favor the rich over the poor. An impartial judge will not favor a non-minority person over a minority person. An impartial judge will not apply the law in favor of males over females. An impartial judge will not apply the law in favor of a Gentile against a Jew. Impartiality means applying the law even-handedly. Where did this idea of impartiality and the essentialness of impartiality come from? Let's take a look at Deuteronomy chapter 1. We've looked at verse 16, so we'll read verse 17. It says, "Ye shall not respect persons in judgment, but ye shall hear the small as well as the great. Ye shall not be afraid of the face of man, for the judgment is God's, and the cause that is too hard for you, bring it unto me, and I will hear it." In the beginning of verse 17, we find the words, "Ye shall not respect persons." Not being a respecter of persons. Where have you heard that phrase before? Who else is not a respecter of persons? God is no respecter of persons. God is impartial. So the judges here were to use, again, evidence. This would be the idea of impartiality. Using evidence, not biases, and using impartiality. No biases, not making decisions based upon bribes or favoritism. No. They were, according to Moses' charge in verse 16, they were to judge righteously. They were to judge impartially. And we also see that ye shall hear the small as well as the great. If someone was have a small social stature in the community, and they were in court with one who had a large social stature, we have these today. You have people that are very powerful, very influential, and of course we have people that are totally unknown. The idea here was that the law would be applied even-handedly, that the one who had the high social standing would not be favored over the one who had a peasant status. And we go further. "And ye shall not be afraid of the face of man." You're not to be intimidated. Don't be intimidated into being partial. Be impartial. No matter if someone intimidates you, whether from a social point of view, from a financial point of view, from a physical stature point of view, from any point of view, do not fear the face of man. Your job is to judge righteously, regardless of the circumstances, regardless of your own personal feelings. You know, there's another interesting text in Deuteronomy chapter 16. It shows you how very, very careful that the Lord was in giving the Torah. This text will not appear on your screen, but it's taken from Deuteronomy, the 16th chapter, verse 19. 16:19 says, "Thou shalt not wrest judgment, thou shalt not respect persons." And here's the point, the next part is the one we want to emphasize. "Neither take a gift." The judges were not to take gifts. "For a gift doth blind the eyes of the wise and pervert the words of the righteous." You know, when you take a gift from somebody, you feel a little bit beholden to them, don't you? And God, through Moses here, says, don't do it. Don't take a gift from anybody because it may adversely affect your ability to be impartial. And impartiality, I am setting a premium on being impartial. Okay. Let's look at a fifth point. Our fifth point we consider is that of just punishment. You know, it's a maxim in our system that the punishment must fit the offense. You're probably more familiar with the maxim of the punishment must fit the crime. Parents kind of use that a lot, you know, in their disciplining of their children. We like to use the word offense because it's more than just criminal activity here we're talking about. So the maxim is that the punishment must always fit the offense. What do we mean by that? Well, we mean that greater offenses are entitled to greater punishment, and lesser offenses merit lesser punishment. Where did this idea come from? Where did the idea come from that punishment should be equal to the offense? Let's consider Exodus chapter 21. Exodus chapter 21, beginning with verse 22. If men strive and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit depart from her, and yet no mischief follow, he shall be surely punished according as the woman's husband shall lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. And if any mischief follow, then thou shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. Friends, we believe that this text is commonly misunderstood. What's the common understanding of this text? The idea of the eye for eye, the tooth for tooth, the hand for hand, and so on. The common misunderstanding in our experience is that this text teaches retaliation. Somebody does something to you, the just and righteous thing is to do that same thing back to them. Right? That's what it sounds like, right? An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and so on. We believe that that is incorrect. We do not believe that this text teaches retaliation. It does not teach the concept of getting even. You know, that's fallen man's way of exacting justice from somebody. I'm going to get even. You've heard the phrase, I don't get mad, I get even. See, that's man. They think that's righteous. They think that's scriptural. They think that's good. We'd like to suggest that it's incorrect and that it's not scriptural. The correct thought of the eye for eye and the tooth for tooth and hand for hand and so on is that the punishment must fit the offense. That's the correct understanding, we believe, of this idea. Let's take a look. We read through verse 25. Let's look at verses 26 and 27. Exodus 21. And if a man smite the eye of his servant or the eye of his maid, that it perish, he shall let him go free for his eye's sake. And if he smite out his manservant's tooth or his maidservant's tooth, he shall let him go free for his tooth's sake. What was the punishment upon the master for putting out the eye or putting out a tooth of his servant? Did the servant get to come back and say, you know, you took my eye, I'm going to take your eye? What was the penalty here? Freedom. The servant was permitted to go free if they lost an eye at the hand of their master or lost a tooth. Friends, the purpose of punishment was not to even the score. The purpose of the punishment was to eliminate the evil. Deuteronomy 19. Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 19. Then thou shalt do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. Well, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? Sounds like eye for eye and hand for hand and tooth for tooth and so on. And look at the last part of verse 19. So shalt thou put the evil away from among you. There's the point. There's the point for the eye for the eye and the hand for the hand and the tooth for tooth and so on. So shalt thou put the evil away from among you. The punishment was to be designed and was designed to eliminate the evil. It was not for the purpose of retaliation. As a practical matter, friends, punishment that is too lenient is neither instructive nor is it reformative if the punishment is not significant enough. But if you go to the opposite extreme and the punishment is too harsh, It terrorizes the community. It upsets them. It upsets the domestic tranquility. It fosters bitterness. It fosters the desire to rebel, to mount an insurrection and to overthrow the authority that's placing this oppressive, this unjust punishment upon us as a people. So punishment that is too lenient doesn't work, and neither does punishment that is too severe. It's only just punishment that works. Just punishment is instructive. It teaches. It reforms. It, above all, even in our imperfect system, will do more than any other standard to tend to eliminate the evil. And that's the point for the just punishment. Let's look at another point, a sixth point. We consider the matter of special care for the needy. Special care for the needy. We're talking here about those who are, in one sense of the word, defenseless. We're talking about the poor. We're talking about those who are aged, those who are blind, those who are disabled, and so on. You know, one of the prominent features of our system, when you stop to analyze it and you stop to take inventory, one of the prominent features of our system is the assistance to the poor, assistance to the disabled, the elderly, and so on. Just a mere smattering. We have welfare for the poor. It's now called public assistance. We have Medicaid for those who are poor, who have no money, and also have no health. We have some of our brethren who are this day taking advantage of Medicaid benefits. We have Medicare for the elderly. We have workers' comp for the disabled, tax benefits for the blind. You ever see those little check the boxes on your 1040? If you're blind, you get an extra personal exemption. Well, either one or two, I've forgotten. Food for the hungry, subsidized housing for the elderly. It's called Section 8 housing. AFDC for children, aid to families with dependent children. Medical care for the mentally ill, benefits for the disabled. You know, there's one other one, friends, I'd like to tell you about, because this just occurred in Pennsylvania. You've all heard of the litigation against the big tobacco. And you've all heard the settlement that they made and the billions of dollars that were placed into the hands of the state governments who brought suit based upon the deceptive marketing practices and the unfair burden that was determined, that was placed upon our healthcare system that all of you here paid for and our ancestors as a result of these deceptive marketing practices fostered by big tobacco. So they paid. They paid billions of dollars. What happened to the dollars? Well, in Pennsylvania did something very interesting. You know, we have the people who are of average or above average income. They can afford health care benefits. The people who are very poor get Medicaid. What about those people in the middle? You know, the state of Pennsylvania looked at the gap. And there was thousands and thousands of people who weren't poor enough to get Medicaid, but they weren't wealthy enough to be able to afford health care. Big tobacco. The state government implemented a program where big tobacco is now paying. And these folks who could not otherwise afford health insurance are now paying about $20 a month for first-class health care benefits. Now, friends, we're not bragging about the system. We're not saying that our system is not one of the kingdoms of this world. We're not saying that it's going to be one of the kingdoms that's going to slide right into the kingdom. No, it's going to be replaced. But friends, here we're looking about a concept. What we're saying is that our government recognizes a special responsibility to help those who are unable to provide themselves with basic human needs. Again, we're not saying the system's perfect. I know there's a lot of things out there that aren't right. But in concept, we as a government recognize our responsibility to the poor and to the needy and to the defenseless. You know what the next question is. Where did this idea come from? Deuteronomy chapter 15, verse 11. For the poor shall never cease out of the land. Well, that sounds familiar too, doesn't it? Remember when Jesus said, the poor ye always have with you? Here Moses is saying, for the poor shall never cease out of the land. Therefore I command thee, saying, thou shalt open thy hand wide unto thy brother, to thy poor, to thy needy in thy land. You know, this was carried out in many different ways. Just a few examples. Every year, there was free food provided for the needy. Remember the rules? Don't glean the fields and don't harvest the corners. Leave some food. Leave some food for the poor and needy. Let them go feed themselves. Every year, this was a requirement. We find in Leviticus 19. Every seventh year, there was more free food. Why? Because every seventh year, whatever grew in the land was not to be harvested. It was left for the poor and for the needy to stock up, to be able to get something to eat. We find that in Exodus 23. In Deuteronomy 24, we find another important concept that protected the rights and protected the needs of those who would otherwise perhaps be oppressed, and that is the requirement of paying daily wages. This, by the way, is the foundation stone, we believe, for the Fair Labor Standards Act that we all have in force in our country today. You must be paid every 2 weeks, and you must be paid in cash. It was based upon, we believe, Exodus. The principle is based upon Exodus, the 24th chapter. In this case, the servants were to be paid every day because of the inherent tendency that there might be for someone of larger economic stature, such as an employer, to oppress somebody of smaller economic stature, which would be a peasant or a servant. Deuteronomy 15 introduces us to another concept, the idea of debt cancellation every 7 years. Remember what we said about God wanting to preserve the sanctity and promote the sanctity of life and liberty? It also even applied to debts. Now, friends, don't get confused here. Deuteronomy 15 is not the Jubilee. But there was a principle, it was a more limited arrangement. Every 7 years, debtors were released from their debts. Because again, God wanted, if he wanted to err on any side, it was to promote the idea of freedom from debt. Because debt, as we know, can be very oppressive. Just a few examples, just a few in the scriptures of how this idea of the poor and needy were taken care of. But you know what the interesting thing, friends, is about this idea of the requirement in the Torah of the protection of those who are defenseless? God issued one of the strongest warnings that we will find anywhere, at least that we found anywhere in Scripture, relative to this subject. God warned Israel. He said, don't even think about it. Don't even think about taking advantage of the defenseless. Let's look at Exodus chapter 22. Exodus chapter 22. Beginning in verse 21. Thou shalt neither vex a stranger nor oppress him, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Ye shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If thou afflict them in any wise, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath shall wax hot. And I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless. Did you note the power of this language? Do you think God meant what he said when he said, when he told them to take care of the poor and the needy amongst your own ranks? You know, God says to them, in essence, if you mistreat them, you're going to answer to me. God is almost saying, I will see to it personally that you are punished if you take advantage of these people. Perhaps God here is really wanting to make a point, a strong point, that one of the most despicable kinds of sin is when the strong feed on the weak. You know, history, friends, has proven that governments who have failed to heed this instruction, the governments who have failed to provide for the poor, have signed their own death warrant. You know, in the late 1700s, the French monarchy, instead of helping the poor, impoverished them. They not only didn't help them, they put a greater tax burden upon them. We're all familiar with the French queen, Marie Antoinette. Brother Russell mentions this, of course, in the fourth volume. Instead of helping to find a way to feed the hungry mobs with bread, she told them, "Eat cake. It's cheap now." What a callous response. And you know what? She not only failed to open her hand wide to help the poor and the needy, but she sent the troops to put down the rebellion for people who were merely clamoring for food. Marie Antoinette violated the law of Moses. Friends, we're not saying the law of Moses was directly imposed upon her, but the principle, the concept of this that's contained in the Torah, Queen Marie violated. You know what the penalty is? We just read it. Queen Marie violated the law, and she incurred the penalty at the base of a French guillotine that took her life. You know, friends, there's many other ways in which the Torah has influenced our system. We are not suggesting that this is comprehensive by any means. In fact, there's a little tiny disclaimer in fine print, because we didn't have room for bigger print. On the table in the back of the auditorium, we've already obtained the consent of the Chicago Brethren that we have a handout, just one page. For any of you who are interested in looking into this matter further, we've only touched just not even a handful of areas where the Torah has influenced, we believe, our system. You're all welcome to take a copy of that, which will be available to you. We have identified, without endeavoring to be comprehensive, more than 40 different ways, distinctly observable ways, that the Torah has influenced our system, our way of life, our jurisprudence. But now, the next question we come to in our lesson is why. Why did God concern himself with this? Why did he worry about setting up a court system? Why did he worry about judge selection? Why did he worry about evidentiary standards? Why did he worry about taking care of the poor? You know, remember what was said in the scriptures that Jesus said? Let the dead bury the dead. You know, the human race is a goner, right? It's already condemned to death. So why bother? Why go through this exercise of setting up all these rules? After all, Israel, as well as the rest of the world, were in sin. They were condemned. They were condemned to die. Why not just let the whole world, Israel and the rest of the world, just degrade in their own sins? Why try to help them out? We believe the answer, friends, is because it manifests something of the love of God. The love of God for His creation. His love, His intense desire to bless His creation, even while they are going through this controlled experiment with sin. The time that we call the permission of evil. God wants to bless His creation, and He wants to teach them something about His own character. And so He wants to bless His creation, not just later, not just when the kingdom is fully set up. Friends, He wants to bless His creation now. He wants to bless them, we believe, during the nighttime of sin, while they go through this very necessary experience with sin. We believe that this principle is taught to us in Deuteronomy, the 15th chapter. Deuteronomy chapter 15, verses 4 and 5. Deuteronomy 15, 4 and 5. Save when there shall be no poor among you, for the Lord shall greatly bless thee in the land that the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it. And only if, there's the biggest two-letter word in the English language, only if thou carefully hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe to do all these commandments which I have commanded thee this day. What was God trying to do with Israel? He was trying to bless them, even in their night of sin experience. But it was only be if they were to obey. So God gave Israel directly, and to all of us indirectly, the Torah, the blueprint of how to be the most blessed, how to be the most uplifted, how to be the happiest amidst this nighttime and this world of sin. It manifests something wonderful about the love of our God. Another question we might ask ourselves is, why have we concerned ourselves with this topic? We've already mentioned it's not because we're trying to boast about our present system or somehow suggest to you that it's going to be exempted as one of the kingdoms of this world that will be replaced by the one universal, the fifth universal empire. We've already suggested that. So why have we concerned ourselves with this topic? Why does it matter to you and to me if we see the law of Moses, the Torah? What does it matter to us if we see the influence of the Torah in our system that we live under today? Brother Russell provides us with the answer on page 607, volume 6, and we quote, "Some, we believe, have gone to an extreme in denouncing present institutions in a manner that the Lord and the apostles neither commanded nor sanctioned, nor illustrated in their words and conduct. We should remember that the world as a whole is living up to as high a standard as it appreciates, and that simply to find fault with matters which others are as powerless to correct as ourselves is worse than useless." That's what Brother Jim taught us earlier today. "Because it merely produces unhappiness, vexation, etc., without accomplishing desired results. On the contrary, the influence, the spirit, the disposition of the new creation should always be toward peace. And if we cannot commend present institutions highly, neither need we specially condemn them. Realizing that the Lord will rebuke present institutions in His own time and manner, we can say to ourselves with the apostle, 'Be patient, brethren. The coming of the Lord draweth nigh. The establishment of the kingdom is near at hand. Will rectify all these difficulties.'" Now, friends, we make an observation, and we ourselves are no exception, so we're not pointing any fingers at anyone. But it's our observation in general that berating our government, castigating our leaders, has become quite fashionable. In fact, it's become the subject of a lot of entertainment. It's become very accepted amongst worldly circles to berate the government, to denigrate it, to castigate the leaders, to find fault. You know, as we scan the daily headlines, as we sit in front of our television sets and watch the nightly news, you know, it's easy. It's easy for us to be ensnared in this worldly trap of berating the government. Berate the president. Berate the judges. Berate the congressman. Run down the system. It's fun. It's entertaining. You know, a lot of people are making a lot of money doing this kind of thing. They're called stand-up comedians, and they love to pick on the politicians. They love to pick on the system. But as new creatures, are we privileged to engage in that type of conduct? As new creatures, we are enjoined. We are given an injunction. And that injunction is to give proper respect to our government and to our leaders. We're not suggesting that we're supposed to admit and go out and boast about them, or to suggest that they're perfect, or that they're not going to be replaced. We're not suggesting that at all. We're suggesting at the present time that our injunction, the injunction that's been given to us, is to give proper respect to our government and to our leaders. Let's take a look at Romans chapter 13. Romans chapter 13. We can read verses 1 through 7, but we'll just, for the sake of time, 1, 2, and 7. "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. the powers that be are ordained or ordered of God. Whatsoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves condemnation. Verse 7. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to fear, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. So the apostle urges us, enjoins us to subject ourselves, to submit ourselves, to give proper respect to the government and to the authorities which are over us. Paul goes further than this. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 1 and 2, he says this, 1 Timothy 2, 1 and 2. I exhort, therefore, that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for some men, be made for all men. All men. Which men? Verse 2. For kings and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. And friends, these two verses are why we ourselves have probed this subject. We believe that if we can see something of the concepts of the Torah in our present system, that it may help to fortify ourselves, that we can see something godly in our present system. It may help to fortify ourselves to develop an appreciation, a proper appreciation, for the system under which we live. Not to boast about it, not to brag about it, but simply to give it proper respect and proper appreciation. And to fortify ourselves against falling into this tendency, this worldly tendency of the exercise of negative energy toward the system under which we live. We leave you now with the words of the apostle in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 17. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 17. Honor all men. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the king.